Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into it with two sources. Sources that argue something pretty terrifying, maybe liberating, that the comfortable conventional life you might be leading, it's fundamentally a lie.
Yeah, that's the core of it. Our mission today is looking at excerpts from two, well, radical 19th century critiques. We've got Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, his philosophical attack, and then Tolstoy's story, The Death of Ivan Illich.
And what's fascinating is how they hit the same crisis point, this authenticity crisis, but from totally different angles. So the big question we're tackling is, what actually happens when all those structures we lean on, morality, social niceties, even objective truth, just get dismantled?
Right. Nietzsche, he's trying to tear them down with pure philosophy, demanding this free spirit go beyond dogma. Tolstoy, though, he dismantles things through, the unavoidable reality of death. He shows us this perfectly ordinary man, Ivan Illich, whose life only looks terrible right at the very end.
Okay, let's start there, with that ordinary man, Ivan Illich, and his dedication to propriety. Let's unpack why his life is called terrible.
Well, Ivan Illich's tragedy is, in a way, his success. He met all the expectations. Tolstoy uses that French phrase, comme il faut, as it must be, that defined him.
Doing the right thing.
Exactly. Everything was about doing what was so considered by those in authority, climbing the ladder, making sure his manners were just so. It's like the ultimate life lived entirely for other people's approval.
And the source immediately shows the brutal irony right after he dies, the way society just neutralizes his death.
Oh, it's chilling. His colleagues, Peter Ivanovich, Fyodor Vasilyevich, they hear the news, and the first thought isn't grief. It's pure calculation.
Like office politics calculation.
Yes. Yeah. Who gets the promotion? One guy might get an extra 800 rubles a year. Another needs to figure out a transfer for his brother-in-law. It's instant.
Wow. It really makes you pause and think about how transactional professional life can be sometimes. The real feeling among his friends wasn't sadness, it was relief, that quote. The complacent feeling that it is he who is dead and not I.
Just brutal. His death is just paperwork and an opportunity. And this constant need for decorum, this comme il faut, it was Illich's shield, you know?
A shield against what?
Against the messiness of real life.
Yeah.
His marriage became this ocean of veiled hostility. So he used his job, which Tolstoy notes carefully excluded everything fresh and vital, to sort of wall himself off, create a safe zone.
Even his house. The furniture.
Yeah, even that. Arranging the house, getting that specific Morocco sofa. It was all part of building this acceptable, decorous bubble away from the unpleasantness, the irritation of his family life.
So layer upon layer of superficial stuff to just keep reality at bay. Okay, that feels like a good bridge. If Ivan Illich's life was this social lie, this fragile setup, Nietzsche comes along and says, wait, the entire foundation of Western thought is a much, much deeper philosophical lie.
Exactly. We're moving from the sitting room decorum to the philosopher's study dogma. And Nietzsche doesn't just go after morality. He questions the whole impulse behind philosophy itself.
How so?
He dismisses that relentless search for absolute, unchanging truth, especially the stuff tied to the soul superstition. He calls it noble puerilism and tyrannism. Basically, dignified but childish efforts.
Right. And he kicks it off with that really provocative question in the preface. Supposing that truth is a woman, what then?
Yeah, it's like saying, hey, you philosophers, you've been chasing truth all wrong, assuming she's rigid and straightforward. His main target is this core belief of metaphysicians. The belief in opposites, the antithesis of values.
You mean like truth can only come from non-error, goodness can only come from selflessness, that kind of binary thinking.
Precisely. He throws out this radical idea. What if the real value of these good things is precisely how they're tangled up, insidiously related, knotted, and crocheted, with the bad stuff, selfishness, illusion, desire?
Yeah, this is where it gets really challenging. He's not just saying they're related. He's saying we might need to assign a higher and more fundamental value for life generally. To pretense, to the will, to delusion, to selfishness and cupidity. Why? Why value what we usually call vices?
Because reality, raw reality, is maybe just too chaotic, too painful to handle neat. So Nietzsche's conclusion is pretty stark. The falseness of an opinion isn't actually an objection to it.
Well, hang on. That sounds completely upside down. Yeah. If being false isn't a problem, how do we function? What does he mean when he says the falsest opinions? And yeah, he uses that technical term, synthetic judgments a priori are the most indispensable. Can you break that down a bit?
Yeah, it's a key point. Synthetic judgments a priori. Think of them as necessary illusions, foundational beliefs we kind of have to accept to make sense of the world, even if we can't strictly prove them. We need simplifications, a kind of constant counterfeiting of the world.
Like what? Give me an example.
Like believing in simple cause and effect, or believing you have a stable, single self that persists through time. Philosophically, maybe these are errors, right? But without them, how would we even act? We'd be paralyzed.
So facing up to that, recognizing that untruth is a condition of life, that's the move that puts a thinker beyond good and evil. You have to admit, the lie might be vital for life itself. And this whole philosophical quest for objective truth, he says it's not really objective at all, is it?
Not at all. He makes that really bold claim. Every great philosophy up till now has consisted of the confession of its originator and a species of involuntary and unconscious autobiography. It's not a neutral search, it's personal. It reveals the philosopher's deepest needs, their moral aims.
Okay, but if every philosophy is just, you know, someone's personal confession, why should we listen to Nietzsche's confession? Why is his system any more valid than Plato's or Kant's?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Nietzsche might say his confession isn't about discovering truth, it's about creating value. You don't follow it because it's objectively correct. You follow it if you find the morality it points towards life-affirming, powerful. He forces you away from asking, is this true, to asking, what kind of life does this philosophy serve? What will does it express?
Right. So if philosophy is moral autobiography, let's loop back to Ivan Illich. His life seems like the perfect example of the morality Nietzsche criticizes most harshly. The morality of the herd.
The gregarious instinct, yeah.
Yeah.
Its main goal is just security, safety, comfort, and alleviation of life for everyone. Simple survival and ease.
And anything that stands out.
Anything that elevates an individual above the herd, anything bold, unique, maybe even a bit dangerous or frightening to the neighbors, gets labeled evil. He puts it very bluntly. Fear is the mother of morals. It's a morality born out of defensiveness, pure utility.
And Ivan Illich lived that perfectly, that fear-based decorum. Which makes his final suffering even worse, because it's not just the physical pain, it's the lie. The collective pretense that he's just sick, not actually dying.
Everyone around him plays along. His family, the doctors, they treat this huge, solemn event of dying like it's just some casual, unpleasant, and almost indecorous incident. It's obscene, really. He's facing the ultimate reality, and his wife is literally planning her night out at the opera.
Oh, that scene with Praskovya Fedorovna, it's just devastating. She comes in, getting ready to see Sarah Bernhardt, fussing about her appearance, her corset, the powder on her face, social obligation, keeping up the illusion, that's the priority, while he's in agony.
The superficial completely eclipses the existential. It's the ultimate insult of that herd mentality, isn't it? Reality must be smoothed over, made presentable, fit for polite company. And this really highlights the difference between the two moral systems Nietzsche lays out, master versus slave morality.
Okay, let's define those clearly. They seem crucial for understanding this whole critique.
Right. Master morality, Nietzsche says, comes from the ruling types, the strong, the life-affirming. It values power, self-glorification, things that overflow. It respects hardness, severity. Its key distinction is noble versus despicable. The noble person creates values, it's self-directed.
So someone operating from that perspective today might look at conventional rules and think, that's fine for them, but it's not my standard.
Exactly. Then you have slave morality. This arises from the oppressed, the suffering, the people focused on survival and easing pain. It values sympathy, kindness, diligence, humility, things that help the group endure. The key distinction here is good versus evil.
And in that system, the good man is?
The good man is the safe man. Harmless, maybe, as Nietzsche puts it, a little stupid, un bonhomme, a good fellow. Ivan Illich, striving for safety and propriety, was the ultimate bonhomme.
And to get beyond that safety, Nietzsche proposes something really difficult, something involving cruelty. I want to pause on that because it sounds so harsh.
Mm-hmm.
He claims almost everything that we call higher culture is based upon the spiritualizing and intensifying of cruelty. What does he mean by that?
It's definitely one of his most challenging ideas. He's suggesting that deep understanding, real cultural achievement, requires a kind of violence against our own instincts. Yeah. Our default setting, our spirit, naturally wants appearance and superficiality, like Ivan Illich's whole life.
Right? Okay.
So to get to real knowledge, Nietzsche argues, you need discipline, compulsion. You have to intentionally injure that default desire for ease and illusion. You have to force yourself to see the uncomfortable truths, to say no to comfort. That self-overcoming, that self-inflicted cruelty or hardness is what forges higher culture, deeper understanding.
So the way out, philosophically, is through this self-mastery, this hardness, and through these very free spirits, these men of experiments, who become commanders and lawgivers. Their job is to transvalue everything, flip the old values.
Yes. They have to reject the bad taste of wishing to agree with many people. For them, knowing is creating. They invent new values. They don't just accept the old ones handed down by the herd. They're strong enough, supposedly, to live without those comforting lies.
Meanwhile, Ivan Illich, stripped bare by his illness, doesn't find a philosopher. He finds his truth-teller in someone much simpler. Gerasim, the peasant servant.
Gerasim is the perfect counterpoint to all the lies. He's the only one who did not lie. Everyone else is putting on a performance of cheerful denial, but Gerasim offers simple, honest physical comfort, holding Ivan's legs up for hours.
And his reason isn't pity in the conventional sense.
No, it's just straightforward acceptance of reality. He says, "We shall all of us die, so why should I grudge a little trouble?" It's this earthy honesty. He acknowledges the truth that the socialites and intellectuals are desperately trying to avoid.
Gerasim embodies that basic truth. Facing death makes all the social games, all the intellectual gymnastics, look pointless. And it's only when Ivan Illich finally accepts this himself, when he admits, "All you have lived for and still live for is falsehood and deception," that everything changes for him.
Yeah, the whole structure of his life just collapses. Tolstoy describes him falling through this narrow, deep black sack, his whole conventional existence, and then suddenly he caught sight of the light.
He realizes his life was wrong, but crucially that it could still be rectified, even at the last second, and the pain goes away.
The physical pain vanishes because the deeper agony, the psychological terror of living the lie, is gone. He asks, "Where are you, pain?" and finds light instead of death.
His final words, so that's what it is, what joy. A complete reversal, finding truth and joy right at the end through the destruction of his proper life.
And that's the synthesis, isn't it? Whether you get there through Nietzsche's demanding philosophy or through the brutal honesty forced by death, like Ivan Illich, both texts scream that we need to shatter the comfortable illusions, the simplified, thoroughly artificial, suitably imagined, and suitably falsified world we build.
Ivan Illich only found something authentic when his respectable world fell apart. The free spirit actively tries to create values outside that world, embracing the harsh truths instead of waiting for reality to crush them.
Exactly. It's about transcending the lie, one way or another.
So what does this deep dive leave us with? Well, it ends with Nietzsche's measuring stick for mental strength, basically. How much reality can you handle without needing it sugar-coated? He asks, the strength of a mind might be measured by the amount of truth it could endure, or to speak more plainly, by the extent to which it required truth attenuated, veiled, sweetened, damped, and falsified.
So maybe something to chew on this week. What comforting falsehoods, what necessary illusions about your job, your relationships, maybe just your own happiness are you holding on to keep things running smoothly? And what might happen if you let just a little bit of that terrible truth into the room?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll be back next time to get into another set of challenging sources.